Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, May 7th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome two astronomers back to the studio. Actually, not in the studio. Their voices will be in the studio. They're not in the studio. They're at home practicing social distancing. I will just talk to them and pretend they're in the studio. Who's in the studio? Well, I'm in. But Bob Berman is not. And Valerie Rapson is not. Yet they're both astronomers, and we'll talk astronomy. You have a question about Mars, comets, gravity? These two are ready. They're on the line already. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. To reiterate, Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, not here, but on the phone, and we'll talk astronomy right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers on the show today to answer your questions about space and everything in it. One of the best known, most widely read astronomers in the world is Bob Berman. He is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. If you have a question about the heavens, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. The number is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes, thanks. Great to be here.
This is the second or third time you have been here on the show without being in the studio. I can't remember now. It's been a while.
Yeah, I think two for me.
Yep, it's true. But hey, we're doing we're all doing fine, aren't we?
Well, I hope so. I mean, we're doing okay here. We're on a skeleton crew, and things move along. And as long as all you are healthy, we will get going with the show. This was on the AP recently. Astronomers have discovered the closest black hole to Earth. It's so close, its sister stars can be seen with the naked eye. The announcement backs up the theory that there are lots of these small black holes in our galaxy, but we just don't see them. And I guess this is, it's not quite close enough to nibble at its two sister stars, but it is warping one star's orbit. Either of you see that news?
I had heard about it. I don't remember exactly how far away it is, but I had heard about this awesome new black hole. And you're right, there's so many of these little black holes that form from these massive stars, and we just don't get to see them unless they have companion stars that are orbiting around them. I mean, by nature, black holes are black. They're dark, right? So we need some light orbiting around it, and we just got lucky enough to catch this one.
Yeah, we needed some more. I mean, there's one famous one in Cygnus the Swan, just a half a degree from the very visible star. Those who know the constellations a little bit and can recognize Cygnus, it looks like a cross, and it is called the Northern Cross, the very middle star. If you go from there to the head star, you get to only one star on the neck. That's Eta Cygni, and that's where it is, just half a degree from there. Little binocular object, eighth magnitude star with the catchy name of HDE226868. I memorized it because it's the only one that's really been obvious until this discovery now. So we really needed a new one. And this star, in every 6 days, gets whirled around like a sumo wrestler, hurled around disrespectfully by something that's very massive. Because, you know, when you weigh 12 times more than the sun, the only thing that can hurl you around is something with more weight. So we knew there's a massive thing there, but it's invisible. And as Valerie can tell you, that doesn't make sense, because the more massive a star is, normally the brighter it is. So when you have nothing there at all, that's your clue. That's a black hole. And then, just like in the new one now discovered, if you also have X-rays coming from the spot, well, that's a good sign, because anything orbiting inward is going to produce X-rays. And if they flicker, if there's a variability on a very short scale, that means it's tiny. And then you put all of that together, tiny, small, you know, very heavy, though, invisible, you know, and then there it is. And then the case is sealed. It's a black hole.
It's Astronomy Today. Valerie Rapson is here and Bob Berman. And I sent this one rather late, maybe 20 minutes before the show. So I don't know if either of you had a chance to take a look, but you may know about it already. This is from astronomy.com. Fast radio bursts could be distant magnetars, new evidence suggests. First of all, for those who don't know, one of you, and you can decide between you which one, tell us about fast radio bursts and then tell us what magnetars are and how they could be connected.
Can I do the magnetar part?
Sure, go for it.
Okay, and then you do the radio burst thing. Well, there was a woman astrophysicist, a Valerie sister, from the University of, I think it was McGill some years back, and she specialized in these things. And a magnetar is essentially a neutron star, which are arguably the strangest objects in the universe. If they spin rapidly, then they're called a pulsar. But, you know, a white dwarf is amazing enough, but they're common. That's an old, shrunken, the gravity is just absolutely incredible because it's a collapsed star. But with a neutron star, it's shrunk even more. So you get the weight of the sun, actually usually more like 3 or 4 or 5 suns, in an object that's only 12 miles across. It could fit between 2 exits on the thruway. And so this is a star that's amazingly tiny, but it's so dense that its surface is solid, and its magnetic field has been ramped up to trillions of times more than Earth's magnetic field. So it's the only objects in the universe where all of their power comes from the magnetic field itself, and we call this a magnetar.
Wow. Now, these fast radio bursts, Valerie, first of all, they've been looking at these for a while, but this one is actually in our galaxy. And so what is the significance of that?
Yeah, so we discovered radio bursts back in the early 2000s, and what they are these very bright, very powerful flashes of light, if you want to call them that, but they're at the radio end of the spectrum. And they only last for a tiny fraction of a second. We're talking milliseconds or less. They seem to flash in the sky, disappear, and usually we never see them again. So they've been this huge mystery to astronomers for a while, and they seem to be coming from other galaxies. Their existence seems to be much beyond the edge of the Milky Way. But this is the first time we've ever discovered one that seems to be within our own galaxy. Measurements of the distance tell us that this object is only about 30,000 light years away, and it corresponds to the same position where we see this magnetar. As Bob said, these really dense neutron stars that are spinning rapidly, they have these strong magnetic fields, and they naturally emit X-rays and gamma rays so we can physically see them. And now this object seems to have spit out a fast radio burst. So we've got a close one in our galaxy that we can study, and it seems to match what we're seeing in other galaxies. So it's possible that all these unexplained radio bursts could just be magnetars in other galaxies.
Aha! So this may solve a mystery. I guess it'll take some more observation to confirm that.
Right. Yeah, we'd like to see a few more before we definitively say that's what the object is, but hopefully we'll catch them.
It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson. Let's take one call here before the first break. 800-348-2551 if you have an astronomy question. And Leo in Gardner, Massachusetts. Leo, you're on.
Hi. I have two questions. One is, where was our sun born? I like looking out at the sky, and I was hoping that you could tell me where it was born, in what nebula, what part of our galaxy, how far away, et cetera. And so if you can answer that one for me, that's a good start.
Okay, should I take the first one?
Sure.
Sure.
All right, it was born here, right here, this part of the galaxy. And there's plenty of gas, hydrogen gas, and dust around in the spiral arms of our galaxy, and what happened is we have just a cloud of hydrogen gas, dusty gas, minding its own business, and then bam, we got intercepted by a supernova remnant, so material from an exploded star, and they have enriched materials. You know, in the Big Bang, there was only ordinary hydrogen and helium, but in a supernova, the star during its life has change things to other things, hydrogen to helium, helium to oxygen and carbon. And so all of a sudden we got all these other elements, metals and even things like uranium and all sorts of things that, bam, contacted this nebula that was right here in the solar system. And the combination of those two gave the nebula a little extra density, gave it a push, maybe helped it spin. And so it contracted to form the sun at the center. This was about 4.6 billion years ago. And any leftover globs forming the planets. And that's why we say the sun is not a first-generation star. It's not made from stuff from the Big Bang. It's not even a second-generation star made from stuff from that was from stars that exploded after the Big Bang. But it's stuff from those stars, the third time around where stars grew and then exploded and then their material came out and met a nebula and formed another generation of stars. So our sun is a third generation star. That's why it's so rich in all sorts of nice things like calcium, of course, in a gaseous form. And so that's what happened here.
All right, Leo, we have to unfortunately cut you off there. We have to take a break. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is joining us today. Valerie Rapson as well. It's Astronomy on Vox Pop, and we'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC Astronomy Today. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, and Bob Berman is here, and this email came in from Chad. And Chad writes, why do planets orbit their host star on a flat plane? Planets never orbit up and over their hosts.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it all has to do with how the stars and the planets formed. So the analogy that I love to use is a ball of pizza dough, right? You start with your spherical ball of pizza dough, toss it in the air, spin it around, and it flattens out into a disk. And that's basically exactly what happened to all of these planetary systems. This nebula that Bob was just talking about before the break collapses down to form a star, and it also forms the planets. And you've got angular momentum that pushes the material outward into a disk, and it flattens all the material, and the planets just form within that material that's already flattened out into a disk. So you end up with all the planets in the same plane, and you only get planets that go high above and below if they interact with another and kind of get kicked out of their system.
Hmm. Okay, well, that's a good answer. Bob, you want to add anything?
No, I like that. And the what we call the inclination to the plane of the ecliptic, that those numbers tell us how much it deviates from a perfectly flat plane. We used to say, well, all planets are flat except for Pluto, because Pluto had a 17-degree deviation from this perfect flatness. Now that Pluto has been demoted, Mercury has the lead, but it's only 7 degrees out of that exact flatness, and 7 degrees is very little. And other than Mercury, all the planets are within 3.4 degrees, that's Venus, from being in that. So it really is quite a flat plane, just as Valerie said.
But Bob, what would account for that 7-degree deviation for Mercury?
Well, you'd actually have to say, why don't we get more? Because when things collide with each other in the early solar system, it was like the Wild West. Things were slamming into other things. In fact, now we think that's how the planets even formed in the first place, from planetesimals, smaller things that kept hitting each other. So every time they imparted a little bit of extra collisional velocity, you could change the orbit a little bit. So more remarkable is why everything even stayed as flat as it did, and no things deviated more than that.
It's Astronomy Today on the program. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Todd is in Pownall, Vermont. Todd, you're up.
Hey, how you doing, gentlemen? I got a two-part question. One is, I heard the polarity in Antarctica has changed a bit in Canada and Antarctica, and I'm wondering why or if that interferes with the weather or changes. And have you guys ever seen any UFOs?
All right.
The truth, don't lie to me.
Oh, boy.
No lies,
well,
Valerie.
I'll take the first one. I'll take the first one, and then I'll let Bob talk about the second one, because he's been watching the sky a lot longer than I have.
Oh, yeah.
So your question about the magnetic field there, you've got this dynamo inside of the Earth. You've got this molten iron core, and it's shifting around a little bit inside. So you're right. It's moving around, and that causes the north and south magnetic poles to shift a little bit. Now, the exact connection between weather and climate is not all that direct. We don't have any strong direct evidence that the shifting of our magnetic field really has much to do with the weather. But it's possible that it might have a small effect, but I don't think it's too strong.
Okay. Like ocean height and, you know, water, things like that?
Right, right. The ocean height has to do with the fact that the climate is warming, so you're melting the polar ice caps, and that water is trickling down and basically raising the level of all of the oceans. But it doesn't seem to be related to the magnetic field at all.
All right. And Bob.
All right, and no radio reception interference, right? With magnetic changes?
You might get a little bit there. It depends. So we try and avoid going exactly towards the magnetic poles for a variety of reasons, not just interference, but you've got particles from outer space that get kind of funneled to that area. So we try and avoid being in those regions.
Hmm.
Well, thanks. All right, Bob. How about the UFOs, buddy?
Well, it's fascinating, of course, and by definition, that just means an object in the sky that's moving and unidentified. And you're right. I've been very interested in this. I've been following it, and being director now of actually two observatories now, people assume that observatories are UFO reporting stations. I'm sure Valerie gets that too, and people call in because they think we're collecting data on UFOs. But it means that we hear about them. And being a longtime pilot, especially I've done a lot of night flying over the Hudson Valley, and that's supposedly a UFO hotspot. So I've been looking, and in almost half a century, I have to tell you, I've never seen one, although there were two instances where I could see that many other people would have said UFO. Now, these days, we've got Venus. We're all noticing that brilliant evening star just after sunset.
Yeah.
It's so bright that surveys have shown that this is the leading source of UFO reports, and it's fooled people as smart as Jimmy Carter when he was governor of Georgia.
Yeah.
And he was a nuclear engineer, remember, and yet he called the state police to report a UFO that proved to be the evening star, Venus. So if you just take a look around 8 o'clock, 8:30 towards the west, you'll see the major source of UFO reports.
Mm.
I have to tell you that I and a friend, also an observatory director from Prescott, Arizona. Actually, they say Prescott, the people live there.
So Prescott,
I remember to say that.
Fine.
Prescott, Arizona.
That's the X-Files over there, isn't it?
I don't know, but there was a loud roar in the valley, and there was a very small craft with only a tiny green light on the front, zoomed over our head. It couldn't have been more than 1,000 feet above us, followed by a giant roar and a much larger craft with no lights, which, as you know, is not legal to fly an aircraft with no lights. And one was following the other low over the mountains here where I live, which is outside of Woodstock, and quite illegal to fly that low. So we assumed these were military aircraft practicing some sort of radar-guided low-level flights.
Mm.
And we later contacted the sheriff's department, who said that they'd gotten a lot of reports from it. Although when I contacted the control towers at the nearby airports, they knew nothing about it. So anybody could have reported that. Nobody would be blamed for saying that they saw or heard or detected a UFO when something like a military aircraft like that was seen, or when a bright planet like Venus is out. But not really. And I once asked Roland Lofredo, who is the head of the Weather Service at the Albany County Airport. He's head of the Albany Weather Service for decades. I think he's retired now, but I once asked him if he or any of his people working under him had ever seen a UFO. And they know the sky. These are meteorologists. And he said no, not once. Never.
Well, I was going to ask Todd if he had seen anything, but we lost him. So that we will have to bring up on another program. However, I would just point out that astronomers, it would not be a good source for a UFO sighting. You're looking through a telescope at something extremely far away, if something whizzes over your house, you're unlikely to be looking at it.
You're right. You're absolutely right. On the other hand, astronomers are the ones who would not mistake Venus for a real UFO.
Well, you make a point.
So I think it is a source. And years ago when I was more interested and I was giving a talk for an astronomy club, like the Mid-Hudson Astronomy Club down in New Paltz, I would ask if anyone would raise their hand if they'd seen a UFO, and I did not see reports. So this does not prove that there are no UFOs. I'm just saying that the lack of seeing them among astronomers is sort of evidence.
Well, there's a stigma attached, Bob. Most astronomers are not going to say a darn word if they're among all the other astronomers if they have a chance of being laughed at, don't you think?
I'm not so sure. You know, we have iconoclasts just like every other group does that would be happy to do something that was not in the mold of everybody else.
Right.
We're also a little skeptical because of the pranks, and there used to be a lot of pranks around the country, especially in our area. There were three pilots in Stormville, flew out of Stormville Airport, who would like to fly information at night, because they love reading about the UFO reports the next day in the Hudson Valley newspapers. So I'm not sure, once you've accounted for the pranks, the hoaxes, the publicity seekers, and the people who mistake things like Venus, not sure there's a lot left to have to explain.
Interesting. Now, we'll get back to our regular astronomy questions in a moment here, but, you know, Bob, just want to, for the sake of the record, the Stormville pilots do not account for all of the hundreds of sightings between the Hudson Valley all the way up to Albany in the 80s. They may have accounted for some. But
No, of course not. And I've heard, I just to give the other side, I've also gotten reports from very, very credible sources. There was a physicist who would tell me about how his family would watch these formations of objects that made impossibly sharp turns at night. And I can't think of any natural explanation.
Okay.
For some of the reports that I've gotten over the years.
Well, Valerie, this is the first time we've actually delved into this. Bob and I have hit these choppy waters occasionally on the program, but now we'll get back to some astronomy here on the program. 800-348-2551 is the number. Wayne in Saugerties. Wayne, you're on.
Hello. I was curious, what is the actual physical force that makes the Earth tilt to cause the seasons?
Ooh. That's
Does anybody
a good question.
Know?
Yeah. So there really isn't a force that's actively like pulling on the Earth. The Earth doesn't have like a sense where it wants to be straight up and down, and something is constantly tipping it to the side. What we think happened is early on in the solar system, when you know things were flying around and planets were getting bumped all over the place, the Earth probably got hit by a large object, maybe something even as large as Mars. And material was kicked up off of the Earth, likely formed our moon, and it left the rotation of the Earth tipped sideways by 23.5 degrees. So that original strike literally tipped the Earth sideways, and then it just naturally stayed that way. And as you said, it results in our seasons.
Yeah, and every planet has a tilt except for Mercury. And so the more puzzling thing is, why does this one planet, although Venus has a very small tilt, Mercury has no tilt. It's less than a tenth of 1 degree. So the real puzzle is, why did we wind up with a planet that doesn't have any tilt? That's the oddity.
Got it.
All right, Wayne, thank you very much. Over to, whoops, that's my bad. There's Zach. Now I get the Golden Zach Award for irritating the engineer. Let's go to Lynn in Wilmington.
Hello.
Lynn, you're on.
Yes. Marilyn. It's Marilyn.
Oh, hi, Marilyn. You're
and,
on.
Okay, thank you. I've been noticing in the last several evenings when it is clear, something very, very brilliant. And by comparison, another star would look like a quarter or a half a dollar. This would look like it's the size of a fist. It is very brilliant. It is in the northwestern part of the sky, and I'm wondering, when I heard about Venus being so bright at 8 to 8:30 at night, I have seen this up until maybe 9:30, and then it seems to be going closer down toward the horizon. But I tried to look at it with binoculars, and I don't know if it is that my hand is not steady enough to hold it, but I really can't view it. And I have seen such brilliance in the sky before, and I'm wondering if Venus sometimes looks like two stars together, but what I am seeing now is looks like a cluster, like maybe four stars together. Am I seeing things? I've had cataract surgery 2 years ago, and I'm wondering if it is my vision. And they
yeah,
say
you
there's
need to,
nothing
you need
wrong
to go
with
back
your vision.
And get your money back. Get your money back from the surgeon, the cataract surgeon, because it's a single object. And brace your. This is how to look at Venus. Don't wait till it's perfectly black. Wait till there's still a little twilight left, because otherwise its true shape, which looks like a crescent these nights, won't be seen against the black sky because it's just too brilliant. It'll overpower it. So when there's still some brightness to the sky left, look at it again with your binoculars, but brace them steadily. Like put them on your elbows on a windowsill or on a car windowsill, and make sure the focus is very, very clear, and look very closely. And if they're, especially if they're 10 power binoculars, most binoculars are only 7 power, you should be able to start seeing it as a little crescent moon.
There you go.
Oh, so that is what Venus normally looks like. It doesn't look like anything that is sort of round or clustered.
Not clustery, but it depends upon where it is in its orbit. When it's on the far side of the sun, the way it was this past fall, and it was also out in the west after sunset then, but it was very far away, so it was dimmer. And then it looked like a full Venus. It looked like a full moon. And then about 3 weeks ago, it looked like a half moon because it was on the edge of its orbit, lit up just on the right side by the sun. And now it's between us and the sun. And increasingly, just in the next weeks to come, it'll be more directly in between us and the sun. And in doing so, it'll be lower in the sky because it has less and less of an angular separation from the sun. But it's more and more lit up on the back side, the side we can't see. And so what's left for us to see is increasingly a thin crescent. But because it's getting closer and closer to us, it'll be at its very close on June 5th. It's getting bigger. So it's bigger but thinner as a crescent. So this is actually the most – I'm so glad you made this phone call, because this is the time, the next few weeks, that's the absolutely best time to be observing Venus through a small telescope or through binoculars. It's just fascinating.
Oh, sorry, Lynn. We lost you there. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Quickly, let's go to Janice in – where are you calling from, Janice?
Ethel.
Ah, it says Ethel on my screen. I didn't think there was an Ethel, Massachusetts. Anyway, you're on the air with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. My question is magnetism. Like, we have the magnetic north in the Earth, and I was just wondering if the other planets and the moon have a magnetic field inside their inside their crust. That's it.
The moon does not. Most planets do, but the moon does not. And Venus also has such a weak global magnetic field that we essentially say it has none. On the other hand, Jupiter is very, very strong. So it really varies from planet to planet. And yes, every planet with a field will have a north and a south pole.
Valerie.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
You want to add to anything?
I'll just add that when we look at the outer planets like Uranus and Neptune in particular, one really odd thing about them is that they have magnetic fields, but they don't seem to be aligned with the rotation axis of the planet. So with Earth, the magnetic field inside of the Earth seems to be roughly aligned within, 10 to 15 degrees of the rotation axis. But like the imaginary bar magnet inside of Uranus and Neptune can be like completely sideways compared to how the planets actually spin and rotate. So that's something we're still trying to figure out, is why are they mismatched and what happened to the planets early on to cause it?
This is very interesting.
Quite right. What Valerie said that I found most fascinating is now she said that in Earth it's pretty much aligned with our magnetic field, but not exactly, because the magnetic pole is not in the same place as the North Pole, which is why this is so cool, that if you have a compass here around here in the Albany area, it won't tell you that north is north. It'll tell you that north is northwest. it'll point 13 degrees to the left of north and tell you that's north, because it's trying to find the magnetic north, not the true geographical north around which Earth spins. So this this little separation, Valerie's totally right, that it's pretty much aligned, but the fact that it isn't makes pilots have to be very careful about what they call deviation from where north is and which way they're flying magnetically.
Let's take a quick break. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. And Valerie Rapson is here along with Bob Berman. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Astronomy Today. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here, and Dr. Valerie Rapson is here.
Oh,
and
my goodness, what just happened to it?
What? Okay. You got
I'm at my home office, and I just walked over to where my bed is, and there was a tick running across the pillow. Not running across, walking across the pillow. I don't kill them, so I was just gathering it up in my hand to throw it out. And I'm opening my hand, and I can't find it. It's gone. The pick is somewhere here, but what happened to it?
Well, maybe we'll have an update before the show is over on that. Valerie, getting back to your point about the gas giants and the magnetic fields, I had just had a question. Given what we know or what we think we know about our magnetic field, and that there is, I guess, a liquidish iron core that is moving around, does the presence of a magnetic field in a gas giant infer something about the composition way down at the center of these planets?
Right. It definitely does, but it's a little bit different than what we experience on Earth. So we think we have a molten iron core, and the fast rotation of Earth causes the magnetic field to be generated. But with the gas giants, we don't think that there's necessarily a purely molten iron core. We think that as you get closer into the center, you've got your hydrogen and helium gases, which is the primary component of those planets. And when they get squished together, they form metallic hydrogen. So hydrogen is actually getting compressed and acting like a metal, and that's what's conducting the electricity and generating the magnetic field.
So there's a solid core on all of these then? In other words, hydrogen is compressed to the point where it is in fact a solid?
So it's compressed to the point where it acts like a liquid. So high pressure, high density actually makes it feel or seem like a liquid. I wouldn't go as far as saying it's actually solidified, because the temperatures and pressures are too high to really have much of anything in solid form.
I got him.
You got the tick.
All right.
So you're ready to field a question, Bob?
Yeah, I'm outside now. I'm going to throw them away. It's a dog tick, not even a lime.
All right, because, I mean,
a lime tick.
You can always ask the tick's
deer
opinion.
Tick, yeah.
David from Kingston, I'm curious how our Earth is protected from solar flares or coronal mass ejections on the rare instances when Earth is directly in the path of one. Bob, you wrote a whole book about the sun's heartbeat. Explain this.
Yeah, a lot of people think that it's our magnetic field that protects us, and it does protect us to a degree, but actually the major protection is just simply our atmosphere that blocks incoming subatomic particles from the sun. Solar wind or extra strong ones that may come from the galaxy itself, comes from beyond our solar system. And you know what? We can't win, because the times when the sun is stronger at solar maximum, like what we had about 8 years ago, that will send more subatomic particles our way, especially if you're near the equator. But at the time when the sun is closer to sunspot minimum, like now, well, then the sun isn't strong enough to put up its normal shield, because that acts as a shield against the worst assault that we get from beyond the stars, from the stars themselves. And then more of those come in at such times like now from beyond the solar system. So either way, they're coming in, and unless you're an unfortunate astronaut like the ones who are above both the magnetosphere and the atmosphere, like the Apollo astronauts, who received significant radiation because of that. And each of them reported once a minute, it looked like meteors going through their field of view.
Yeah.
It turned out that this this stuff, these subatomic particles, were darting through their vitreous humor and their eyeballs and through their brains and making them all see these spurious flashes of objects going across their field of view.
Yeah.
At first, they didn't tell anyone because most of them were old Navy pilots, and you learned long ago you never report to any doctor that anything is wrong with you in any way.
Right.
You just don't do it. But they were telling each other that enough so that eventually NASA caught on that these guys are experiencing it, and that was what the caller was talking about, except if you're beyond Earth, you don't have the protection from either our atmosphere or our magnetosphere.
Bob Berman is here. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. And let's go to Chris in Altona. Chris.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Talking about your subatomic particles and perhaps coming from the sun, I read somewhere that neutrinos, small bits of matter that aren't really detectable, pass through the Earth, and as they're passing, approaching the Earth, they are actually black holes that then either it's the atmosphere or the magnetic field or maybe fissile elements in the Earth's core that cause them to collapse and disappear. Is there anything to that? I am totally mystified.
Yeah, no,
what
no,
we're
no,
talking
that's
about.
True. That's not true. No, not true.
That's not true.
Neutrinos are the most common particle in the whole universe. They're created in the sun's core as a byproduct of the nuclear fusion that gives us all our nice heat and light from the sun. But they don't interact with normal baryonic material, with atoms either inside our Earth or not. And that's why, and this is an interesting stat, 4 trillion of them go through each of your eyeballs per second. They don't hurt you because they don't interact with anything. And this is what I find amazing. By day, we get them coming through our heads, passing through our whole bodies, and then going through planet Earth. At night, when the sun is below us, they come up through the Earth. They go through the entire planet Earth in a 20th of a second, each one of them, pass through the entire Earth, which doesn't even slow them down or block any of them. And then they come up through our bodies from our feet upward and then exit through the top of our heads going on.
And it doesn't have any capacitance kind of effect on matter?
No, not only matter, it can help us, can't hurt us. It's sort of like those Hare Krishna people at airports.
Ah, Bob, jeez, really? Oh, great. Well, the address to complain is voxpop@wamc.org. Chris, thank you for that one. And Bob, thank you for that one. And Tracy in Pine Bush. Tracy.
Hi. This question is about satellites. I had observed satellites when I was a kid, and it really got me interested in astronomy, and that's one of the reasons why I go out and look. And I took my daughter out to the backyard the other night to go make some s'mores and noticed a string of 8 satellites traveling in a straight line, and immediately went to the internet. I live in Pine Bush, which is a huge UFO area.
Sure is, yeah.
Known for, but I am definitely a skeptic on that, but I knew that some of my friends that are true believers would be inquiring as to what that was, so I had to find out the answer, and I learned about Starlink, and I've gone out subsequent to that and seen as many as 24 in a row.
Yep.
I'm just wondering how long this I know it's kind of a pain for long-term photos of certain doing observations. I just wonder how long they will last. How long will this these strings last?
Now you're going to irritate the astronomers, Tracy. All right, Valerie, you go first.
Yeah, so they're going to be up there at least for another couple weeks, you know, easily visible in the sky. They may not be visible for us the entire time, but what they're doing is they are slowly separating from one another, and they're slowly moving upwards in an orbit. And eventually they'll get to the point where they're not as easily visible as this really nice, bright string. But they're going to be launching more. What you probably saw was from the most recent launch. It was 60 satellites just like 2 weeks ago they launched, and they're kind of getting to their final spots right now. But the plan is to have thousands of these satellites get launched and create this web across the world that will ultimately give us all really high-speed internet, which is great. But as you mentioned, they get in the way of astronomers. You know, we have to look through and look past these satellites. They're constantly ruining the pictures that we're trying to take with our telescopes of the night sky. So great for visual observing, not so great for actual astronomy.
Yeah, you know, Bob, we were out, I think I talked to you guys about this the last time you were on, but we were out again over the weekend, and I think we counted 15 in a row. And they're not exactly close to each other, but one will still be in the sky just fading as another couple are coming along. It was unbelievable.
Nobody was asked, is this okay to take a major part of nature, which is the night sky, the beauty of the night sky, and essentially despoil it or change it artificially forever? I don't know why the public was not considered. I mean, what if somebody was going to ruin rainbows or the Grand Canyon or some other aspect of nature? And that's what's going to happen. When there are thousands, there'll be more satellites than there are stars in the sky.
Well, I am told that in addition to the galaxy of satellites going up here with, Musk, that I think Samsung plans to put 4,000 up as well at some point in a similar venture.
Yes.
Eventually, things will start banging into each other, right, Valerie?
Yeah, they're getting really close together. I was actually just putting a presentation together this month. Our listeners can look at for it on the Dudley Observatory's YouTube page later this month. But it talks exactly about this, how crowded outer space is getting. And in low Earth orbit and where the geosynchronous satellites are, they're not that far apart. We're only talking about tens of miles apart in some cases, which is not a lot considering how much space is actually out there. So we've got to be careful about these thousands of satellites we put up, because you're right, they will eventually bump into each other and cause space junk that are going to endanger the astronauts when they go up there.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson, and Nancy is in Rhinebeck. Nancy.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your program.
Thank you.
I have a real interest in science, retired teacher and all that.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh. Did we lose you, Nancy, after all that time? Uh-oh. All right. Well, if Nancy, call right back. I think your signal went. And going once. Oh, Nancy's gone. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we need some more satellites so signals like that don't get lost.
Thanks, Bob.
I know, right?
Max in Northville. Max, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering how we detect the composition of atmospheres and or surface material on other planets or celestial bodies remotely?
Yeah, the short answer to that is spectroscopy. We've got these devices where we can look at light bouncing off of the atmosphere or bouncing off the surface of other planets. We can break the light into the rainbow of colors, and all of the different elements have their own fingerprints, their own colors that they either absorb or emit. And by looking at those fingerprints, we can determine exactly what the Martian atmosphere is made of or the surface of another planet is made of.
Okay, so would that be something like a refractive index of some sort?
Yeah, you earned the right idea. Refractive index is the bending of light. That's how we can actually get the spectrum. So the white light is bent and we create that rainbow. But the spectroscopy aspect is really either absorbing or emitting very specific wavelengths, very specific colors of light based on the atom or molecule that's doing the absorbing or emitting.
Okay, how would we differentiate between the atmosphere and the crust of a planet with light having to pass through that atmosphere to then reflect off of the planet itself?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question, and that's something that we struggle with, because you're right. You've got the light going through the atmosphere, it comes back, so it's affected by the atmosphere twice, and you've got the surface features that are affecting it too. So it just comes down to being somewhat intelligent about what might be in the atmosphere versus what might be on the ground and attempting to disentangle the two. So it takes a lot of
time. It's an amazing thing, and it started in 1859 with two buddies, two friends, Robert Bunsen. Remember Bunsen burner?
Oh, sure.
From my chemistry class.
Yeah.
And Fraunhofer. And the two of them were hanging out and noticed there was a fire in a house about a mile away, and they used this new device they had, which was essentially a prism, piece of cut glass, with a little bit of a slit at first in front of it, and they saw in the light of the fire the very lines of a spectrum that they had noticed in their lab that were created by substances in the lab, elements like iron and calcium that were made to glow, had a certain pattern of lines, and they saw the same lines in the fire of a burning building. And one of them said of the other, Bunsen, he just made a discovery, and he can't sleep at night. He's so excited. He just can't sleep thinking about this. And they realized that now, for the first time, you could tell what the stars were made of. All you had to do is look at their light through this newfangled device, a spectroscope, and instead of all the colors blending and blurring together, you could see the individual patterns, like a fingerprint, that each element gives off. And for the first time, determine what they were. Later on, we found that if an object's racing away from us, all the lines shift their position in one direction, comes toward us, it shifts towards the blue. That stars that look single could be told that they were really a double star because you'd see two sets of lines where, through a telescope, it looked like just a single point of light, and on and on and on, till these days, more than 75% of all astronomers' time is spent on spectroscopy and nothing else.
All right, listen, Nancy from Rhinebeck is back. Nancy, we only have 1 minute, so can you answer ask the question very quickly?
I'm just wondering how much of a real reality the scientists there think it will be for people to be able to walk on Mars and explore Mars the way we did on the moon. So that will be a reality.
All right, Valerie, you first. We have 35 seconds.
I'm optimistic, but I think we have a lot of engineering hurdles to jump over first. We want to make sure the astronauts do this safely and humanely before we just send them off to Mars.
Bob.
And I'm less optimistic because we always say about 20 years in the future. Nowadays, we're saying the mid-2030s. So 15, 20 years, we always say people will be on Mars, and we've been saying that since the 1970s. So I'll believe it when we see it.
All right, Valerie, you had mentioned...
Yeah, I'm wondering.
Oh, go ahead.
My grandson is 12 years old, and I'm just wondering, in his lifetime, if that will happen.
Ah, you think it'll happen?
I hope so.
All right, Nancy, thank you very much for the call. We're all done. Valerie, you had mentioned a YouTube channel for the Dudley Observatory. Let's give it a plug real quick.
Yeah, if you just go to YouTube and look up Dudley Observatory, you can find some of our public lectures there. I've been recording them and posting them since we can't do them in person. So there's one from April up now, and come mid-May, there'll be this month's talk all about satellites and space junk.
Oh, very, very cool. Well, thank you both for being here. Support comes from New England Falconry, located in Hadley, Massachusetts, and Woodstock, Vermont, offering introductory, extended, and group hands-on sessions, as well as hunts through field and forest with a trained hawk, newenglandfalconry.com. And the Linda, WAMC's Performing Arts Studio, offering a full-service recording studio for music productions and voiceover projects, thelinda.org. Once again, thanks to astronomer Bob Berman and astronomer Valerie Rapson for being here. Thank you for listening. Sorry if we didn't get to your calls. And thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Charlene Knight. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we bake stuff. We welcome the folks from Brimstone Bakery for our Food Friday. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.